What the hell did he say? All I got was gibberish.
Kane reached up behind his head to make sure the contact transceiver was still tight against the mastoid bone behind his right ear. Grant tapped the PDA unit in his coat pocket.
Me too. Maybe the translation program isn't working.
More likely, he's speaking a language that doesn't have a match in our linguistic database.
Just to make sure, she brushed back her fall of hair and touched her own contact. Steel pintles implanted in the bones slid through the flesh into tiny input ports on the small curves of metal. The contacts had been found in Redoubt Yankee and were described by Filboid as state-of-the-art multiple-channel communication devices. Their sensor circuitry incorporated an analog-to-digital voice encoder that was subcutaneously embedded in the mastoid bone. The pintels connected to input ports in the comms themselves. Once they made contact, transmissions were picked up by the auditory canals, and the dermal sensors transmitted the electronic signals directly through the cranial casing. Even if someone went deaf, as long as they wore a contact, they would still have a form of hearing. The contacts were still being field-tested, since in order to make them operational, surgery was required, and few people wanted to make that sacrifice. But the surgery was very minor, involving only a small incision behind the ear to slide the sensors under the skin. In conjunction with the sophisticated translation program within the PDAs all of them carried, the contacts analyzed the pattern of a language and then provided a real-time audio and verbal translation. Some foreign phrases and words wouldn't be exact translations, but the program recognized enough words to supply an English equivalent. Conversely, the program would supply them with the appropriate responses in the language it heard. But the old masked man's voice had filtered into all their heads as a garbled torrent. His eyes behind the slits of the mask were dark and expectant.
I think he's waiting for us to say something.
I recognize the language he speaks.
The old man's eyes darted toward him, then widened.
Enlilirugal shibara icha me yenden. Keshtug me yenden. Zimi yenden. Ukustami ulia baab tumudien. Ima shega benilziki yangu.
His lean body was consumed by shivering. Then his bones seemed to turn to molten wax and flow down to the ground. He prostrated himself and pressed his forehead against the flagstones. Kane knew the old man's reaction stemmed not from terror, but from an awe so intense it was almost a religious ecstasy. His two companions remained prone on the ground, not lifting their heads or even appearing to move.
Eme gilima, gusum gibil, eme girgi.
Anadug, sagenta namtar.
He is speaking a dialect of Sumerian, which is related to no known language, living or dead. I asked him to use a bit more current form of verbal communication.
And who does he think you are, one of his gods?
No, only a messenger. The term he applies to me translates as Archon of Destiny.
Interesting bit of synchronicity, if it is such.
Kane seriously doubted it was. Over the past couple of years, he had learned Archon was a Gnostic term that described both guardians of spiritual planes and jailers of the divine spark within humanity. Ultra-top-secret groups within the U.S. military and intelligence agencies referred to Balaam and his people as the Archon Directive. After World War II, a pact was formed between elements in the United States government and the Archons, essentially a trade agreement for high-tech knowledge. Part of the exchange allowed the Archon Directive use of underground military bases. Following the nuclear holocaust of January 2001, the Archon Directive became the Archon Directorate. During the first century after the holocaust, a number of Archon secrets, developed under the totality concept, were discovered by survivors. Through human and inhuman intermediaries, the Archon Directorate intervened to prevent the rebuilding of a society analogous to the pre-Dark model. The Archon Directorate eventually interceded directly in the development of the most powerful baronies and instituted the program of unification in order to prevent a resurgence of the inefficient pre-Holocaust societal structure and also to hide the existence of the so-called Archons and the totality concept from all but a small portion of humanity. However, Balaam revealed that the Archons and their ruling council, the Directorate, existed only as appellations and myths created by the pre-Dark government agencies as control mechanisms. Lakesh referred to it as the Oz effect, wherein a single vulnerable entity created the illusion of being the representative of an all-powerful body. It seemed clear now that Balaam and his kind were known as Archons long before being codenamed as such by either the military or intelligence agencies. Kane once again reflected wryly that when it came to Balaam, the only thing he could be sure of was that he could be sure of nothing. Recently, he and his friends had learned that the Archons were never the hidden masters of humanity, but custodians created by two races who didn't belong on Earth, who hadn't evolved here. The Tuatha De Danann and the Anunnaki, despite all their influences on humankind's development, were from outside, and they feared some aspect of humanity's nature. Grant glanced around, first at the mosaic under his feet, then at the stone pillars, and finally craned his neck up at the ziggurat bulking overhead. He estimated the base wall stood at least 50 feet tall and extended well over 200 feet from corner to corner. The topmost building, constructed atop an elevated superstructure, measured a minimum of 150 feet from the desert floor. The structure was big, but only a molehill in comparison to a mile-high five-sided pyramid mountain he and his friends had recently visited on Mars. He sidestepped away from the reflective surface that made up the eye of a serpent's profile on the mosaic.
I'm guessing we're where we wanted to be. A rock.
Brigid seemed to become fully aware of their surroundings for the first time.
Mesopotamia stands alongside Egypt, the Indus River Valley, and China as a birthplace of permanent human culture.
Not to mention it's where the snake faces hung their hats. But then, where didn't they?
He shook his head to drive out the last wisps of disorientation. Traveling by the interphaser didn't cause the same kind of deleterious physical side effects as the gateway units, but the transit process wasn't exactly soothing to the nerves either. When a vortex node was opened, travelers were plunged into a raging torrent of light, wild plumes and whirling spindrifts of violet, yellow, blue, green, and red. Swirling like a whirlpool, glowing filaments congealed and stretched outward into the black gulfs of space. Streaks of gray and dark blue became interspersed with colorful swirls. They felt themselves plummeting through an alternately brightly lit and shadow-shrouded abyss, an endless fall into infinity. They were conscious of an instant of whirling vertigo, as if they had hurtled a vast distance at blinding speed. Then the sensation of freefall lessened. The darker colors deepened and collected ahead of them into a pool of shimmering radiance. Suddenly, they were somewhere else. Kane shivered, but not because of the cold. The desert air felt hot on his face, and he considered shedding his coat. He and Grant wore ankle-length, mag-issue black Kevlar weave coats. They offered a degree of protection against penetration weapons, and they were insulated against all weathers, including acid rain showers. They made sure the sin-eaters were secure in the rather bulky holsters strapped to their forearms beneath the right sleeves of their coats. The sin-eaters, the official sidearm of the magistrate divisions, were automatic hand blasters, less than 14 inches in length at full extension, the magazines carrying 20 9mm rounds. When not in use, the butts folded over the top of the blasters, lying perpendicular to the frame, reducing its holstered length to 10 inches. When the weapons were needed, a flexing of wrist tendons activated sensitive actuator cables within the holsters and snapped the pistols smoothly into their waiting hands, the butts unfolding in the same motion. Since the sin-eaters had no trigger guards or safeties, the auto-pistols fired immediately upon touching their crooked index fingers. Long combat knives, the razor-keen blades forged of dark, blued steel, hung from sheaths at their hips. Clipped to their web belts were abbreviated copperhead subguns. Less than 2 feet long, with a 700-round-per-minute rate of fire, the extended magazines held 35 4.85mm steel-jacketed rounds. The grip and trigger units were placed in front of the breech in the bullpup design, allowing for one-handed use. Optical image intensifier scopes and laser auto-targeters were mounted on top of the frames. Low recoil allowed the copperheads to be fired in long, devastating full-auto bursts. Although Brigid Baptiste wore no coat, her willowy body was encased in a one-piece skin-tight garment. Kane and Grant were attired in duplicates. The black garb had been christened shadow suits. The material of the form-fitting coveralls, which resembled black doeskin, had become important tools in the Cerberus ordnance and arsenal over the past few months. More than once, the suits had proved their worth and superiority to the polycarbonate magistrate armor, if for nothing else than their amazing internal subsystems. Composed of a compilated weave of spider silk, monochris, and spectra fabrics, the garments were essentially a single crystal metallic microfiber with a very dense molecular structure. The outer Monocris sheathing went opaque when exposed to radiation, and the Kevlar and Spectra layers provided protection against blunt trauma. The spider silk allowed flexibility, but it traded protection from firearms for freedom of movement. The suits were almost impossible to tear, but dense and elastic enough to deflect arrows and knives. Unlike the mag exoskeletons, a high-caliber bullet could penetrate them. Balam gestured to the masked man.
Arise! What shall I call you?
Standing up on legs as wobbly as those of a newborn foal's, the masked man bowed his head.
Resura, I am the High Priest of Endil. What shall I call you?
Balam.
Resura jerked in reaction, his eyes catching a glint of starlight, so they gleamed eerily in the holes of his mask.
I have heard that name before. It is the name of the Night Demon who commands 40 legions, who defines the past and future, and becomes invisible.
Oh, he's still up to that, buddy. Or he tries to give that impression anyhow. Bridget, recalibrate the interphaser and make sure it can get us back home when we need it, like before the overlords show up.
Bridget's back stiffened at the peremptory tone, but she knelt beside the little metal pyramid and touched a seam on its alloyed skin. From the base, a keypad slid out. The interphaser had evolved from Project Cerberus. Over 2 years before, Lakesh had constructed a small device on the same scientific principle as the Mattrans gateways, a portable quantum interphase inducer designed to interact with naturally occurring hyperdimensional vortices. The interphaser opened dimensional rifts much like the gateways, but instead of the rifts being pathways through linear space, Lakesh had envisioned them as a method to travel through the gaps in normal space-time. The first version of the interphaser hadn't functioned according to its design and was lost on its first mission. Much later, a situation arose that necessitated the construction of a second, improved model. During the investigation of the Operation Kronos installation on Thunder Isle, a special encoded program named Parallax Points was discovered. Lakesh learned that the Parallax Points program was actually a map, a geodetic index of all the vortex points on the planet. This discovery inspired him to rebuild the interphaser, even though decrypting the program was laborious and time-consuming. Each newly discovered set of coordinates was fed into the interphaser's targeting computer. With the new data, the interphaser became more than a miniaturized version of a gateway unit, even though it employed much of the same hardware and operating principles. The Mattrans gateways functioned by tapping into the quantum stream, the invisible pathways that crisscrossed outside of perceived physical space and terminated in wormholes. The interphaser interacted with the energy within a naturally occurring vortex and caused a temporary overlapping of two dimensions. The vortex then became an intersection point, a discontinuous quantum jump beyond relativistic space-time. Evidence indicated that there were many vortex nodes, centers of intense energy, located in the same proximity on each of the planets of the solar system, and those points correlated to vortex centers on Earth. The power points of the planet, places that naturally generated specific types of energy, possessed both positive and projective frequencies, and others were negative and receptive. Lakesh knew some ancient civilizations were aware of these symmetrical geo-energies and constructed monuments, like geodetic markers, over the vortex points in order to manipulate them. Obviously, the eye inset into the mosaic was one such marker. Once the interphaser was put into use, the Cerberus Redoubt reverted to its original purpose. Not a sanctuary for exiles, or the headquarters of a resistance movement battling the tyranny of the barons, but a facility dedicated to exploring the eternal mysteries of space and time. Interphaser version 2.0 had been lost during a recent mission to Mars to unlock a few of those eternal mysteries. Bridget Baptiste and Brewster Filboid had worked feverishly over a period of a month to construct a third one, but with expanded capabilities. They had completed Interphaser version 2.5 only recently. The test jump proved that it worked perfectly, despite the fact that it phased Brigid, Philboyd, and Nora Pennick into the middle of an interfactional war in Cambodia. Grant eyed the prone bodies of Rasura's companions.
Are they asleep or unconscious or what?
Kane stepped over to them, prodding each man gingerly with a toe.
One is an or what. I think he's dead, probably from heart failure. The other one just doesn't seem inclined to get up. But you'd think he'd want to. We literally scared the shit out of him. Leastways, I assume it was us.
Classy. Maybe somebody should make sure he's dead and not just unconscious. We've got medicine.
Rasura bent over the body of his companion and poked and prodded for a moment.
Amner is dead.
You don't seem very broken up over it.
Amner grew old in the service of our master, the Lord of the Air. Now our god will allow him to rest, to know everlasting peace. At least he lived long enough to fall neath the gaze of Enlil's messengers. Come, I will guide you into Acre, so that our god may know all is in readiness for his return.
That'd be Jim Dandy.
They started up the ziggurat. Under any other circumstances, Kane would have assumed point position. But Rasura had begun mounting the steps in a very ceremonial, dignified manner, beckoning to them. Grant followed him, with Brigid and Balaam sandwiched between him and Kane. If Kane disliked bringing up the rear, he kept his objections to himself. He continually checked their back trail.
You know, more than 80% of all known Sumerian literary compositions have been found at Nippur. Included were the earliest recognized versions of the Flood story, parts of the Gilgamesh epic, and dozens of other compositions.
You don't say.
Grant gazed up along the flight of stairs to the point where they intersected with the first terrace of the ziggurat. The steps ascended at a very steep angle, and his balance was off because of the interphaser's carrying case slung over a shoulder. The device itself wasn't particularly heavy, but the power pack that enabled it to function was as bulky and solid as a brick. As they climbed higher on Acor, Kane made out the individual structures of Nippur, or where they had once stood. A long wall had toppled and was half buried in the sand, and many buildings had collapsed into heaps of rubble. It was difficult to discern the original lines of the structures, since they had all been scoured smooth by windswept sand. The reconstructions of the buildings, however, were very easy to differentiate.
Anyway, those compositions are as important in historical terms as royal inscriptions from all periods, especially those of the Kassite dynasty, which ruled Mesopotamia from about 1600 to 1225 BC.
It was 1238, actually.
You'd be the one to know, I guess, since your people probably destroyed it.
Balaam glanced down at him dispassionately, and Kane sensed again the loneliness and pain radiating from the entity like an invisible aura.
Sorry. Climbing ziggurats at night always makes me bitchy.
Balaam turned away without a response. Dourly, Kane reflected that dates and places of human civilizations were the least of what Balaam and his people knew. His folks' knowledge of hyperdimensional physics had proven that, at least insofar as the Mattrans units were concerned. But they hadn't shared their knowledge that the gateways could accomplish far more than linear travel from point to point along a quantum channel. Kane still harbored a bit of skepticism of Balaam's version of the hidden history of Earth, despite the fact he had encountered nothing to prove it false. And if he had done nothing else, Balaam had removed, with only a few words, the threat of the Archon Directorate and given hope to the exiles in Cerberus. During the first year of his time in Cerberus, he and his friends accepted as gospel that the global megacull was not humanity's fault at all, but due to the deceptions of Balaam's people over the long track of centuries. Later, they came to understand that the so-called Archon Directorate hadn't really conquered humanity. It had tempted humanity with the tools to conquer itself. Unregenerate greed, naked ambition, the monomania for power over others were the carrots snapped up by the pre-dark decision-makers. In order to survive, Balaam and his folk had deceived humankind. But it was humanity's choice whether to live down to its worst impulses or rise above them. Rasura led them to the top of the stairs, where they intersected with the first level of the ziggurat. The ramp stretched off and up to the right, climbing at an ever-increasing angle. Without pause, the masked priest began trudging across the terrace and up the next incline. Grant dropped back to walk behind Kane.
The Padre is being suspiciously cooperative.
You notice that too. Could be he just wants to impress the Archon of Destiny.
Or he wants to trap the Night Demon and his friends inside a pyramid.
Ziggurat. But yeah, that possibility did occur to me too.
Grant nodded. His Sin-Eater slid from the holster beneath his right sleeve and slapped solidly into his hand.
Keep our triggers set.
Kane didn't unleather his own weapon, but he allowed Grant to precede him as he brought up the rear again, alert and aware. The fleecy clouds had dissipated from the face of the moon, and enough light fell onto the structure so that they could at least see where they were putting their feet. Kane was concerned that Grant might stumble and drop the interphaser, damaging it so they could not transit back to Cerberus. Although the device's carrying case was cushioned and insulated, he was still uncertain of just how delicate a mechanism it might be. The decision to use the interphaser to make the transit to Iraq had been reached quickly. Balam scanned the parallax point coordinates in the database and selected one that he claimed correlated with the longitude and latitude of Nippur. Although Lakesh wanted to accompany them, he saw the wisdom of not putting all of the key personnel, the command staff as it were, in jeopardy. Besides, he had the utmost faith in Kane, Bridget, and Grant to handle anything they might encounter. Lakesh had once suggested that the trinity they formed when they worked in tandem seemed to exert an almost supernatural influence on the scales of chance, usually tipping them in their favor. The notion had both amused and repulsed Kane. He was too pragmatic to truly believe in such an esoteric concept, but not even he could deny that he and his two friends seemed to lead exceptionally charmed lives. Still, he felt a little guilty about leaving while Quavel was in labor, but Balam's insistence that time was critical overruled DeFore's protests. Although Kane hadn't discussed it with Grant and Bridget, he knew they shared his own distrust of Balam's story of the rebirth of the Anunnaki overlords. That was the main reason Grant had refused Chizuka's offer to come along with them. He risked her ire to keep her as safe as he possibly could. Not long ago, the Cerberus warriors had been afforded a glimpse of their future, and it bore no relation to what Balam had described. According to the message conveyed to them from 27 years hence, Sam ruled in a preeminent position of global power following a long conflict called the Consolidation War, but there had been no mention of Anunnaki involvement. However, the actions undertaken by Kane, Grant, and Bridget to make sure such a future never came to pass could have shifted probabilities sufficiently to set in motion an entirely new series of events, which in turn created a branching timeline. Or, he reflected bleakly, the rebirth of the Anunnaki was always predestined. The future of the Consolidation War was the aberration, the accident. Something he had done or had yet to do, or not do, brought that alternate timeline into existence. Kane winced at a pinch of pain between his eyes. His brain wasn't flexible enough to deal with reality-bashing ideas like those, so instead he concentrated on scaling the ramp to the next terrace. Although the surface of the ramp underfoot was smooth, it was also grainy and gritty, which made the upward progress slow and laborious. One of Grant's footfalls caused a section of the ramp to crack.
How stable is this thing?
Compared to what?
To the pyramids, for example.
The pyramids were built from enormous stones that often had to be transported for long distances. The Mesopotamian ziggurats were built from small mud bricks that were locally produced.
Mud?
Don't worry. I don't think it's going to rain anytime soon.
A heap of debris that had fallen from a higher terrace formed a barrier the five people were forced to clamber over. Bridget lifted Balam atop the heap of rubble like a mother would a child.
Thank you.
Balam's endurance surprised Kane. Still, the entity trudged resolutely onward and upward at the dirt-crusted heels of Rasura. Finally, the ramp opened onto the summit of the ziggurat, angling sharply into the open entrance of the flat-roofed shrine. Kane took a moment to catch his breath, glad for the fresh breeze blowing in off the desert. He looked toward the horizons and saw only rolling sand dunes stretching away like a brown ocean. The narrow ribbon of the Euphrates flowed into the darkness and distance. Far below lay Nippur, its empty streets winding between ruins and sheared-off columns. Bridget stepped up behind him.
Nippur and her sister city-state, Ur, were the main centers of civilization and learning in this part of the world. They represented a highly advanced culture that predated pharaonic Egypt by 2,000 years.
Yeah. Too bad it was built to worship a bunch of scaly-assed aliens who thought they were gods.
As he started to turn away, a flicker of light caught his attention. Eyes narrowed, Kane moved closer to the edge, gazing down at the colonnade. The eye in the center of the spiral mosaic sparkled dimly, as if it reflected an errant glitter of starlight.
What is it?
I guess that depends on your definition of...
Kane's spine stiffened in reaction to a sudden chill, as if ice cubes had been dropped down his back. A fluttering finger of incandescence stretched up from the glossy surface of the mosaic's eye. Suddenly, the mosaic and the entire promenade erupted in a blinding explosion of white light.
Shit!
Dazzled, Kane shielded his eyes with his hands, aware of an undulating drone synchronized with almost continuous bright bursts of energy stabbing at his optic nerves.
Ah!
Vision swimming with flare-induced floaters, Kane peered through watering eyes at the dark presences arrayed around the mosaic. Because of the swirling mass of white energy surrounding the figures, finer details escaped him, but he guessed there were at least a dozen, quite possibly more. With each new flash of light, more figures seemed to appear. He didn't back away from the edge, despite his point man's sense urging him to do so as quickly as possible. Grant stepped up on his left side and stared down. Through the milky haze, they caught only fragmented glimpses of hairless heads scaled in vivid hues of green, crimsons, and gold. They were crested with back-curving spines. They couldn't make out individual features, but what they saw was enough to freeze them in place.
It appears the Overlords and the Nephilim have arrived a bit ahead of schedule.
They could see now that the passageway curving through the interior of Ekur was as smooth as if the clay had been wax, pierced at a downslanting angle by a red-hot needle. They moved for it quickly. It wasn't completely dark inside the ziggurat. Both walls were paneled by cool blue squares that shed an eerie, pellucid light. Grant, Kane, and Bridget had seen the luminous panels before and knew they were of Archon manufacture. The passage curved much like a gentle spiral, extending downward on an ever-steepening decline.
Balam, what's the damn drill?
Specify.
Do we make a stand here and pick off the overlords as they come in?
That will not solve the problem of Tiamat. No. Enlil will seek out the Tablets of Destiny in the Tabernacle. If he finds them, he will also find a portal by which he and the others will transport to the ship.
Bridget strode behind a very apprehensive Rasura and Balam and tried to keep both of them within the field of her vision.
A portal? Do you mean a mat transunit?
Not precisely. The Anunnaki called them thresholds. They are to one of your gateway units as an ox-drawn cart is to a supersonic aircraft.
Sam, Enlil, used the heart of the world to get him and the overlords here. So why would he need this threshold to transport to the spaceship?
Your question is its own answer. The energies of the heart of the world utilize natural geomagnetic streams and intersection points of the planet, much like your interphaser. Tiamat is patently not on the planet.
Kane dredged up an image from his memory, one that Balam had imparted to him during their telepathic exchange 2 years before. He recalled archways, seemingly sheathed in flame.
The thresholds look like arches, right? That's how the early Anunnaki colonists came and went from Earth to Tiamat.
Yes.
Uh-oh. Sounds like the gang's all here.
Let's move it.
Oh, Balam of the 40 Legions, why do we flee instead of welcoming the Assembly of the Gods?
As the eyes of Enlil, he will see what I see. The Tabernacle must be in order. If so, he will join us there and reward you for your diligence. If it is not in order...
Balam knew Rasura's imagination would conjure up far more terrifying threats than mere words could deliver. Rasura quickened his pace. In order to keep the old man in sight, Kane, Grant, and Bridget slipped on night vision glasses, the lenses of which were treated to amplify and enhance even the poorest light source. Balam didn't need an artificial aid to his vision, since his people's optic nerves operated far more effectively in murk than did theirs. Rasura hustled through doorway after doorway. Bridget followed directly behind him, her right hand resting on the butt of the TP-9 autopistol snugged into the holster attached by Velcro tabs at the small of her back. As the concourse curved ever downward, she repressed a shudder. Although she didn't frighten easily, plunging into the shadow-shrouded belly of the ancient temple awakened in her a lurking, atavistic fear, a rising sense she was rushing headlong into hell. The angle of descent suddenly decreased. Almost as suddenly, the passageway opened into an immense chamber, like a vast hollow pyramid within the ziggurat.
Damnation.
The ceiling was paneled by the blue light squares. The tiled floor gleamed with an elaborate multicolored mosaic, a much larger version of the one outside the ziggurat. Four fluted pillars stood at equidistant points around the chamber, but their purpose seemed more for design than function. The floor area formed a perfect square, and Kane guessed the corners stretched 100 feet from one another, extending 140 feet on the diagonal. Dangling from the apex of the high ceiling, suspended by a web of wires, hung a gold-leaf stone sculpture fashioned into an exaggeratedly noble likeness of the crowned head of Enlil. It stared down with a fathomless gaze upon the massive altar. The lidless eyes were composed of the same luminous material as the light panels. The altar itself was of simple construction, with heavy stone columns and the straight lines of a 20-foot-long horizontal rock slab, supporting a fragment of pale blue crystal. Triangular in shape, like the walls of the chamber itself, it reminded Brigid of a splinter of shattered glass. Nearly the height of Grant, the crystal glimmered as though cut from an enormous amethyst.
"This place is damn near as big as the outside. That means most of the building is hollow."
"Ziggurats were said to house the divine source of light and energy as a living connection to the gods. Sometimes even the house of the gods. They had to be big. Through the ziggurat, the gods could be close to humankind."
Brigid stepped up to the altar, staring at the shard of crystal in silence, one part of her mind noting clinically that the kaleidoscopic pattern of reflections within it had a slightly hypnotic effect. Another part of her mind listened to what seemed to be a chorus of faint, distant voices, thready and whispery tones that gently brushed and caressed the edges of her awareness. She heard no words, only the murmuring song of a phantom choir, singing from a place and time so far in the dim past that no one should possibly be able to hear, much less understand them.
"What the hell is that?"
"Oh!"
Kane's question, spoken quietly into her right ear, caused Brigid to jump. She shook her head as though roused from a nap.
"I think it's a Shem-An-Na, the altar of the Starfire."
"Oh, that explains a whole lot of nothing."
Gazing around the chamber with alert eyes, he noticed a freestanding archway of dull metal positioned at the opposite side of the chamber from the altar. It reminded him of pics he had seen of the lintel door frames in pre-dark cathedrals. In height and width, it looked to be an exact match for the fragment of blue crystal.
"The Starfire was a sacred crystal venerated by the ancient Sumerians and their descendants. Some scholars postulated it was the basis of the Philosopher's Stone used by alchemists. By staring into it long enough, it was reputed to heighten spiritual perception by imparting the arcane knowledge stored there by previous generations. The Tuahad Danann employed something like it. Remember the Speaking Stone of Kaskarik?"
Morrigan, the blind telepath from Ireland's Priory of Awen, had told Brigid that ancient priesthoods knew stone and metal and crystalline things retained a memory. They could be charged with ancestral memories like storage batteries.
"I remember you talking about it."
Despite his dismissive response, Kane recollected everything they had ever learned of Anunnaki mental abilities. Sumerian texts repeatedly asserted the Anunnaki were all connected. No singularity existed among them. What one knew, all knew. A giant shard of crystal that stored the electromagnetic pattern of their mind energy, functioning like a database, didn't seem completely out of the realm of plausibility. Grant stood at the entrance of the chamber, less interested in the interior of the tabernacle than the corridor they had just left. Sin Eater in hand, he peered into the gloom.
"It'll take them a while to get here."
Kane nodded, then turned to face Balaam.
"And then what?"
"When the Tablets of Destiny are retrieved by the Overlords, you must appropriate them."
"Just like that? You make it sound like they'll be only too happy to give them up if we ask nicely enough."
"I did not intend to convey that impression. There may be a struggle, and if so, blood will most probably be spilled. But the tablets must not be damaged."
"How the hell do you even know they're in here?"
"Tradition."
"What's our tour guide here know about them?"
Unaided by a contact, Rasura had listened patiently to the exchange in a language he didn't understand. Balaam put the question to him in Arabic.
"The Tablets of Destiny are here, where Enlil placed them for safekeeping over 3,000 years ago. Only he may lay claim to them. As you should know if you serve him, why do you come here?"
"We are the eyes of Enlil."
"I do not believe you are. I believe you are enemies of the gods."
"You are mistaken. We came here at the summons of Enlil."
"It is strange that I, who am the ancestral high priest of Nippur, know nothing of any summons. If you are truly the eyes of Enlil, you should be leading his procession here, to the tabernacle."
Kane realized the old man was fast losing his sense of awe in the presence of the Archon of Destiny. Suspicion took its place. Grant made a casual but deliberate show of blocking the doorway, just in case Rasura tried to bolt.
I shall be the judge of what I should do.
With his right hand, Rasura reached inside his robe as if to scratch at a louse bite. Then, with a speed surprising for a man of his years, he whipped out a leaf-shaped bronze-bladed knife.
Ha!
The engraved point touched Balaam's short, slender neck. Grant took a half-step forward, but stopped when Balaam waved him back.
You are a demon and seek to deceive me so that I will betray my god.
You are making a misjudgment and perpetrating blasphemy.
You think me a fool? I know of the demon spawn of the gods, how they repaid the gods' trust with treachery. Your name was prominent on the tablets and scrolls I studied as a novitiate. Emnil will reward me for capturing you and your familiars. Do not resist. My knife has been blessed and inscribed with magic symbols. It will slash asunder all ensorcelments and witchcrafts.
I will not resist.
Tilting his head back, he studied the priest's half-concealed features as if he found them utterly fascinating. Rasura's lean body began shaking like a wind-blown leaf. The knife fell to the floor. Slowly, he sank to his knees, covering his face with trembling hands.
The old Archon fear whammy. That should keep him from warning the overlords, or doing much of anything.
It is most effective on primitive minds, as you should know from experience.
A profane rebuttal leapt to Cain's tongue.
We've got to get him out of sight.
She touched the priest on the shoulder, but he didn't react. Balaam's telepathic infusion of fear had robbed the old man of his ability to think and act. Grant and Cain stepped over to him and latched onto an arm each. Heaving Rasura up from the floor, they dragged him into the narrow space between the rear of the altar and the wall. Using cloth strips torn from his robe, the two men swiftly but expertly hogtied him, binding his skinny ankles to his equally skinny wrists. Rasura's leather mask made an effective gag, jammed between his jaws and kept in place by a rawhide lace from one of his sandals. Rasura didn't struggle or even give any indication he was aware of what was happening. He kept his eyes squeezed shut during the entire process, breathing fitfully through his nostrils. When they were finished, Cain and Grant returned to the center of the chamber.
Now what?
Now we must hide ourselves. The overlords come.
Crouched in a wedge of shadow stretching between a pillar and the left-hand wall, Cain struggled to control his rising anxiety. The notion of lying in wait to ambush 9 reborn Anunnaki seemed worse than ill-conceived. In retrospect, it fit the definition of insane. He wondered bleakly if Balaam might not have exerted a more subtle form of mental manipulation on him and his friends to persuade them to agree to the plan. He resisted the urge to peer around the pillar to make sure Grant and Bridget were both in their positions of choice, arranged to catch the overlords in a triangulated crossfire if circumstances necessitated such a maneuver. Balaam had joined Rasura behind the altar stone, presumably to keep him fearful and compliant.
Status, Baptiste?
I'm set.
Grant?
Set.
Acknowledged.
Because the contacts transmitted the electronic signals directly through the cranial bones, they could hear even the barest of whispers from one another. The tramp of footfalls grew in volume, and shadows flitted at the doorway. Cain pressed against the pillar, listening to his own pulse pounding in his temples. Adrenaline raced through his bloodstream. He took a deep breath and tried to concentrate. He told himself that whatever came through the door was mortal, not divine or demonic. A tall figure swept into the tabernacle, striding with a ceremonial pomposity and an almost serpentine grace. Draped in a billowing robe of saffron hue, the creature bore no resemblance to Sam, nor to any of the barons he had ever seen. Still and all, Cain knew instantly he looked at Enlil. Although his height was awesome, nearly 7 feet, he was gaunt of physique. The scaled skin of his hairless head glistened in the pallid blue light shed by the eyes of the giant effigy suspended from the roof. Enlil's flesh glittered slightly, as if a pattern of metal were sewn into the flesh. The crest of spines curving back from the crown of his skull gleamed with a metallic luster, like wires made of burnished steel. The resemblance to the preserved corpse of Enlil was superficial in the extreme. The figure marching imperiously into the chamber made the preserved body of the original creature seem like a crude plasticine sculpture by comparison. Cain remembered what Balaam had once telepathically imparted to him. The Enlil that was is not the Enlil that now is. At the time, Cain had not closely examined the meaning of Balaam's cryptic comment. Now, finally, he knew exactly what Balaam meant. A man a full head shorter flanked Enlil, wearing the tight-fitting jumpsuit of dark metallic weave favored by hybrids. However, he didn't look like a hybrid. His nose was short, his lips a thin slash above a blunt chin. High cheekbones and craggy brow ridges framed his most disturbing feature, his eyes. They were deep-set, the irises as white as pearls. Like Enlil, he was hairless, and his dark skin bore a pebbled pattern of scales.
Enlil and one of the Nephilim.
The texture of Balaam's telepathic insertion into his mind was at once familiar and unsettling. Cain had been in psychic communication with Balaam before. He could only assume that after the first mind-to-mind channel was established, a semi-permanent link had been forged.
Barons Cobalt and Sharp arrive.
Two more figures entered the tabernacle, both of them wearing the ceremonial robes of the barons, but the pair didn't look anything like the individuals Cain had met in the past.
Now they remember who they were thousands of years ago, Lords Marduk and Nergal.
Cain had spent more time in the presence of Cobalt and Sharp than any other members of the baronial oligarchy, but he saw almost no trace of the arrogant vengeance seeker or the half-mad trickster against whom he had contended on more than one occasion. Although Marduk and Nergal were not identical to each other or to Enlil, they both shared the same protuberant bony ridges overhanging shadow-pooled eyes and scaled skin stretched tight over sharp-boned faces. The crests of spines sprouting from their skulls were not as long as Enlil's, and they shimmered iridescently with different colors. Brick red for Nergal and cobalt blue for Marduk, which, Cain reflected, was only appropriate.
Baron Mendi, Lord Zu, Baron Palladium, Lord Dumuzi, Baron Thulia, Lord Shamash, Baron Snakefish, Lord Utu, Baron Samarium, Lord Ishkor.
Cain repeated Balaam's words, conveying them by whispers to Bridget and Grant over the contacts. Whatever their reactions, his friends kept them private. Baron Beausoleil stalked through the door last, the taut, scaled flesh of her proud face shining like polished amber. She moved with a liquid symmetry, a hip-swinging, swaggering superiority.
Lilitu, the succubus of ancient legend, the seducer of man's dreams.
8 Nephilim accompanied the overlords. All were the same height and general build, with the identical scaled skin, inhuman white eyes, and blank expressions. They looked less like retainers to alien royalty than the walking dead. Cain struggled to reconcile the sight of the tall, regal aristocrats striding into the tabernacle with the memories of the small, fragile creatures who had ruled the baronies from the shadows of their high, isolated Ares. As the hybrid barons, they had been a beautiful folk, and as the overlords, they were still, but now there was something terrible, even revolting, in their beauty. With their gracefully arrogant movements and glistening skins, they were like a group of pampered, depraved children. Their fierce, lusting eyes put Cain in mind of overthrown monarchs who had long been held in captivity in filthy dungeons, but now had cast off their chains and climbed out of the pits to retake their thrones. Erica Van Sloan's words ghosted through his consciousness. The kings are returning to their kingdom. Cain easily recalled the conditioning undergone by the magistrates that instilled in them the belief the barons were kings, demigods, their personal deities, and thus deserving of their unquestioning obedience. Even learning the barons were products of synthetic wombs and recombinant DNA hadn't completely stripped them of their semi-divine mystique. To see them now, transformed and evolved into creatures of myth, entities who had indeed behaved and been worshipped as gods, evoked emotions somewhere between terror and bleak resignation. But sparks of anger glowed in there, too, to be fanned into a full blaze. Cain hoped he would have the opportunity. Enlil moved to the altar, the 8 overlords gathering around him in a crescent. The 8 Nephilim took up parade rest positions on either side of the slab of stone, 4 to a corner.
Enlil Urugal Shibara et Shamenden. Geshtumenden. Zimienden. Ukushtami Urli Abaab Tumuden. Ima Shegaben Lil Zikyangu.
Light suddenly bloomed from within the shard of crystal, a flare of yellow radiance that lit up the area around the altar like the breaking of dawn. The light within the crystal grew brighter. The chanting raised Cain's nape hairs. Somehow, he knew it was an ancient hymn, preserved from an age beyond human remembrance. The faces of the overlords were intent, their eyes eerily reflecting the glow from the crystal. The light emitted by the starfire pulsed in rhythm with the song, increasing in brilliance until Cain had no choice but to remove his night vision glasses or risk damage to his optic nerves. The crystal resonated with the chorus, its sharp edges humming.
What the hell is going on?
As if on cue, the shape of the altar shifted as a long section of the flat forepart rose on invisible pivots like a lid. On its underside, multicolored lights blinked and flashed from within glass-encased readout screens. 9 metal cylinders, gleaming as if made of polished chrome, pushed their way upward. 5 metal bands encircled each one.
A machine. Their altar is a machine.
Deus ex machina. So even the Anunnaki made demigods of their machines. That's good to know.
Why?
Behind all the ritual, there are some very basic scientific principles in operation. The altar is equipped with sound sensors. The overlords hit the right notes in the proper combination, like unlocking a safe. Gods wouldn't need such things.
Cain didn't contribute to the conversation. He fixed his attention on Enlil as he removed the metal bands from the chrome cylinders and passed them out among the overlords, arrayed behind and around him. Each one of them took 5 of the circlets. Moving with the same swift, sharp motions as if all of the overlords were mirror images of one another, they shrugged out of their robes, letting them drop to the tiled floor. They stood naked before the altar, bathed in the pulsating shimmer of the starfire, their sleek, sinuously muscled bodies seeming to ripple in the lambent aura. Only Enlil did not strip. With a studied, almost rehearsed synchronicity, the overlords snapped the bands of metal around the bases of their necks, their wrists, and their ankles.
What the? They came all the way from their baronies to try on jewelry?
From the circlets of alloy flowed sheaths of gleaming metal, writhing and sliding from their necks, down over their torsos, up their arms and legs. Like mercury, the liquid substance pouring from each of the bands joined in sections, then sculpted itself to conform to the shape of the individual body. Within the space of a few heartbeats, the material molded itself into a final form. As it solidified and metallicized, it acquired colors and detail. The armor encasing the bodies of each overlord glistened with a different tint that reflected the color of their skull crests. On the left pectoral, the metal swirled to create a different cuneiform sigil for each one, the personal emblem of the overlord who wore it. The armor was obviously some kind of metal, but as pliable as stiff cloth. With both arms, Enlil gestured imperiously to the Nephilim, who numbly and dumbly had observed the transformation process. One by one, all 8 shuffled forward, standing before Enlil with bowed heads. From within the altar, Enlil removed disc-shaped pods, approximately 6 inches in diameter, flat on one side, convex on the obverse. Each one was of a different color. He slapped the flat side of a red pod hard against the chest of the nearest Nephilim. With a soft click, it adhered there, magnetically, signifying it had locked into place. Spinning the man around, Enlil placed another disc on his back, between his shoulder blades. From the outer edges of the pods sprang ribbons of liquid alloy, spreading swiftly over the dark mesh of the man's bodysuit, interacting with the garment, acquiring new shapes as the substance slid across his torso. The tendrils formed themselves into inch-thick reinforcing epaulets on his shoulders, and then crept down the sleeves to sheathe his hands and forearms in gauntlets. Raised humps on both wrists gained dimension, and three short hollow barrels protruded from them. Flexible conduits snaked out from cuffs, curving around to connect with the red pod attached to the man's back. Kane recognized a weapon when he saw one, but he had no idea of what kind it could be. Another section of the red-tinted alloy shifted and elongated into a heavy collar encircling the base of the man's throat. A half-ovoid shell sprouted from the rear, sweeping up to enclose the back and upper portion of his skull. From its underside, hair-thin filaments extended down to pierce both sides of his hairless head. He winced slightly, then stepped aside, allowing another Nephilim to take his place. Kane's mouth filled with a bitter tang of fear, muscles quivering from barely leashed adrenaline.
Baptiste, what is all that?
I don't have any idea. I've never seen or heard of anything like it.
It is not sorcery, Kane, but technology. You would call it a smart metal, a liquid alloy that responds to a sequence of commands programmed into its extruder. A miniature cohesive binding field changes it from liquid to solid. The Nephilim are being outfitted in their traditional battle armor and personal weapons. Directed energy emitters known as ASPs. Accelerated stream of protons.
Even Balaam's assurance that they were not looking at magic didn't calm Kane. He experienced a sensation of dread, a realization that the smart metal extruders were probably only the first of the terrifying traditional artifacts to be retrieved by the reborn Anunnaki.
What can we do against weapons like those?
Follow my lead.
Kane didn't know what Balaam meant, but he resisted the urge to ask for clarification. He repeated to Bridget and Grant what he had been told about the smart metal and the weaponry.
What the hell are accelerated stream of proton emitters? Like the quartz cremators we found on the moon base?
Kane pictured the deadly pulse plasma rifles and their sectionalized barrels that terminated in long cylinders made of a crystalline substance. He also envisioned the manner in which bodies exploded from within when struck by the accelerated ion stream.
I sure as hell hope not.
I doubt they are. But that doesn't mean I want to face them without having some idea of what they can do.
They fell silent, watching as Enlil applied the pods to the Nephilim as they stepped forward, sheathing them in identical but differently colored armor and half-helmets. After each one was equally attired and outfitted, Enlil returned his attention to the open altar stone. He gave the distinct impression of rummaging through a trunk. Kane eased around the pillar in order to get a better look, Sin Eater held in both hands. Enlil's claw-tipped fingers removed flat square panels from narrow slots in the instrument board. They looked to be made of a dark, reflective, glassy substance, but he didn't handle them as if they were fragile. They were the same general shape and dimensions as oversized playing cards, and dots of colored light played across their surfaces in 9 ordered rows, like the beads on the strings of a Chinese abacus.
Are those the Tablets of Destiny?
Neither Balaam, Bridget, nor Grant offered a response. Kane decided not to repeat the question. He watched as Enlil touched a glowing dot on one of the panels with the tip of a finger, moving it across the surface. Enlil's eyes lost their focus, seemed to look inward.
Zoo.
Armored in green, Lord Zhu stepped forward and received the card from Enlil, holding it reverently in both hands. He bowed his crested head in acknowledgement or gratitude.
I judge those are the tablets, just like I judge they're attuned to the individual overlord, either their genetic code or brainwave frequency, or both.
Kane's hand tightened around the butt of his Sin Eater. He guessed Enlil could somehow identify which tablet was attuned to what overlord and distribute them accordingly. Retrieving them from one hand would be easier than from 8.
What the hell are we waiting for? Let's make a grab for the tablets.
Negative. Balaam said to follow his lead.
What lead?
I guess we'll know when we see it.
I think we may be seeing it now.
From around the left end of the altar stone shuffled a robed, masked figure, fingers steepled together at his forehead.
Rasura? Did Balaam cut him loose?
I think so, but for his own purposes.
Rasura's eyes glittered with a hard, almost inner light. He swept Kane's hiding place with a swift, dispassionate gaze and inclined his head in an almost imperceptible nod. When Cain met those dark eyes, he felt his flesh prickle despite having witnessed the phenomenon before.
It's Balaam. He's using Rasura as a channel, like he did with Banks.
Grant and Bridget understood his reference. Twice before, Balaam had used the psychic rapport he shared with Banks as a channel of communication, essentially possessing him. Cain fancied he could glimpse Balaam's huge, slanted black eyes superimposed over those of Rasura. He was overwhelmed once again by the knowledge that with Balaam, almost anything was possible, even mentally directing the body of the old priest like a puppet. A Nephilim wearing purple-tinted armor caught sight of the old man before any of the overlords. Instantly, he raised both arms, holding them straight out from the shoulder, aligning the energy emitters mounted atop his gauntlets with Rasura. Three flanges, shaped like the letter S cut in two, sprang out with a flare of sparks and a crackling hiss of energy. The metal curves were tipped by the stylized heads of adders in postures of rearing back for a strike, their mouths agape, red energy pulsing in their gullets. Cain understood why Balaam had called the weapons asps. The name wasn't so much an acronym as it was an accurate description.
Mosquito.
Enlil checked the Nephilim's movements with a sharp single-word command. Immediately, the soldier dropped his hands to his sides, the flanges clicking shut. The priest continued walking slowly forward, taking short, jerky steps as if his ankles were hobbled. The eyes of all the overlords turned toward the hunched figure of Rasura. He stutter-stepped up to Enlil and bowed deeply from the waist, hands still pressed together at his forehead. Then slowly he dropped to his knees. Even Cain was impressed by the sincere-seeming display of groveling. Enlil stared down at him imperiously, then a slow, condescending smile tugged at the corners of his thin mouth. He placed the tablets atop the altar and directed his full attention to the old man.
Uzuk umeda na'agi'in.
Reaching down, Enlil snatched the leather mask from Rasura's head, revealing a bald, liver-spotted pate surrounded by a fringe of gray hair. He examined the mask, gingerly holding it by thumb and forefinger as if it were a dirty diaper. His nostrils twitched in mock repugnance, and he flung the headgear aside.
Enlil Urugal Sibara Icha Mienden. Geshtug Mienden. Zi Mienden. Ukustami Uliabab Tumudien. Ima Shagaben Lilziki Angu.
Cain wondered if any of the reborn Anunnaki overlords were impressed that a human had tried to keep alive the ancient, muddled religion that deified exploiters from another world. Impatient, Enlil bent and secured a grip on the collar of Rasura's robe. With one heave, he jerked the old man to his feet, his molten gaze passing with a detached clinical measure over the priest's browned, deeply seamed face. He shifted his grip from the collar to the man's wattled throat. The priest lowered his hands from his forehead, but still kept them pressed together as he prayed. Rasura's eyes were so liquid with adoration, for an instant Cain doubted his first assessment that Balaam controlled him. Then the old man's eyes became as hard as chips of anthracite. Rasura's hands parted, and cupped between them lay the bronze-bladed knife. For an instant, the light shed from the starfire danced along its edge. Then, with a swift slashing motion, he whipped the knife toward the neck of Enlil. The edge of the blade sawed for a microsecond against the flesh beneath Enlil's left jaw hinge. With the speed of a striking viper, Enlil's hand closed tightly around Rasura's throat, thrusting him backward and twisting simultaneously. The tabernacle echoed with the crack of bones breaking, the mushy crunch of flesh and muscle being crushed against vertebrae. The man's body hung limply in Enlil's grasp, his arms and legs shaking in a violent tremor. Life went out of his eyes with the suddenness of a candle being extinguished. Contemptuously, as if Rasura weighed no more than his robe, Enlil flung him away, hurling him bodily across the chamber. The back of his head struck the wall. Cain gaped in shock, not spying so much as a pinpoint of blood on Enlil's neck. He had no idea if the death of Rasura would adversely affect Balaam's mental equilibrium, but at the moment, he didn't consider the possibility very salient. A white-hot torrent of loathing and hatred completely smothered the fear and awe the resurrected Enlil had evoked in him. All the repressed hatred and seething rage he felt for Thrush, for Sam, for each and every one of the Barons roared out of the dark recesses of his mind and heart. It so consumed him he shivered as if with a chill. The door-slamming bang of a gunshot startled him, made him jump. He then realized he had squeezed off a round from his Sin-Eater without knowing what he had done. Left hand cupping his right, finger hovering over the pistol's trigger stud, he saw Enlil clutch at his chest and stagger backward. Only the altar kept him from falling. Despite the long range, his shot had struck dead on target. Cain felt almost as astonished as Brigid Baptiste, Grant, and the assembled overlords. Their crested heads whipped around to stare at him in incredulous wonder, which was quickly replaced by raw fury. They may have been the Anunnaki Supreme Council reborn, but they retained their memories as barons, and their hatred of him. He stared back, watching how Enlil's eyes narrowed with pain, with confusion. He waited for him to fall.
Cain, water!
Lips peeling back over his teeth, Enlil pushed himself to his full height. With both hands, he grasped his saffron robe at the collar and with one heaving motion ripped it from his body. He threw it from him, eyes fixed on Cain. They blazed with a pure, malign energy, and even a kind of savage satisfaction. His lips molded into a smirk of superiority. Beneath the robe, Enlil's body was naked, but a glittering armor clothed his lean frame nevertheless. His neck, chest, arms, and legs were coated with a pattern of tiny interlocking scales that resembled chainmail. Belly slipping sideways, Cain realized why Enlil hadn't put on the smart metal extruders. He did not need them, since an organic form of armor covered his body, more than likely a characteristic bestowed on him by the nanomachines he had controlled in his incarnations as Sam and Thrush. Three jointed metal spines curved out from his shoulder blades like the skeletons of wings. Gazing unblinkingly at Cain, Enlil used the claw-tipped thumb and forefinger of his right hand to dig at his left pectoral. His smirk became a grimace of effort for a moment, then returned to a smirk as he plucked a little flattened cylinder of metal from his chest. Flipping the bullet in the air like a coin, he caught it and hefted it on the palm of one hand.
You only get one free shot, Cain.
Enlil's proclamation was the signal for the overlords and the Nephilim to burst into a medley of angry yells and a confusing mill of rushing bodies. Grant interpreted it as a cue to lean out from his sheltering pillar and fire his copperhead in a long staccato burst. Bright brass arced out of the smoking ejector port, tinkling down at his feet. A blue-armored Nephilim was hammered off his feet, sparks flying from the multiple impact points. Howls and shrieks of fury erupted from the throats of the overlords, echoing and re-echoing within the tabernacle. They dropped flat or took refuge behind the altar. The Nephilim took up protective positions around Enlil, enclosing him in a bastion of flesh and alloy. One of the Nephilim, wearing purple armor, extended his arms, the viper head snapping up on his gauntlets. Triple streams of eyeball-searing yellow light spit from the serpent's mouths, joining together to form a coruscating globule of plasma that jetted toward Cain like a fireball launched from a catapult. He ducked back behind the pillar as a kaleidoscopic bolt of colors and energy splashed against the stone. More autofire from Grant's copperhead rattled, weaving its stutter around single-shot cracks. A round from Brigid's TP-9 drilled a hole through the jaw of one of the Nephilim, punching him backward with such force the back of his helmeted head hit the edge of the altar with a gonging chime. A scarlet geyser erupted from his mouth and a severed carotid artery. She felt a surge of elation that the pearl-eyed zombie was mortal, but just as quickly she felt regret that she had no choice but to kill the mind-controlled soldiers. She reminded herself that in legend, the Nephilim were the illegitimate children of fallen angels, wandering, lost souls. Brigid framed the Nephilim beside him in her sights and squeezed off a three-round burst that pounded dents in his red armor, propelling him backward but not knocking him from his feet. He nearly went down, feet sliding and seeking purchase on the polished floor. Catching himself on the corner of the altar, he fired a stream of orange cord energy from his left-hand aspen emitter. Scrambling back to cover, as the bolt of plasma lashed through the air a finger's width above her head, Brigid felt the flash of heat on her scalp, and then the stink of scorched hair filled her nostrils. Desperately, she patted the top of her head with her gloved hand, hoping to smother any flames that may have ignited in her mane of hair. She looked around for Cain and glimpsed him shoulder rolling from behind his pillar. Enlil saw him too, and he screamed orders to the Nephilim.
Kabari! Kabasugar!
Cain, what the hell are you doing?
One of us is going to have to get the tablets, so cover me.
Grant leapt out from behind his stone shelter, raised his copperhead to his shoulder, and raked the armored figures of the Nephilim with a deadly stream of autofire. Only one of the Nephilim went down, clutching at his throat. Blood spilled between his alloy-coated fingers. His companions fired asp bursts in Grant's direction. He backpedaled as fast as his legs would allow. A bolt of energy fanned a splash of scalding hot air on his face, and another brushed the color of his coat, turning a spot of the fabric a charcoal gray. He didn't know if the mag coat could turn an asp blast, and he didn't care to find out.
God damn it, Kane! Think of something fast!
Kane didn't bother to respond. From his prone position, he took hasty aim with his Sin Eater and fired a burst at the four armored men still standing in front of Enlil. At the same time, he heard Bridget open up with her hand blaster. A storm of rounds pounded into the Nephilim, jarring them, staggering them, but not penetrating their alloyed carapaces. A flurry of asp bolts lanced toward him, and Kane threw himself backward in a frantic somersault, trying to roll ahead of the deadly bursts of energy. They smashed into the floor within inches of his body, showering him with fragments of tile, peppering him with white-hot sparks. Bridget dropped to a crouch with her back against the stone column, her TP-9 held high. Carefully, she peered around the corner. Instantly, the rock exploded under the impact of another asp burst, scouring her left cheek with sharp bits of stone and grit. Only the hair screening the side of her face protected her eyes. Easing down on one knee, Grant swiftly reached out around the column and kept the trigger of his subgun depressed, posing down the area around the altar with a steady spray. Several rounds chopped fragments out of the edge of the crystal.
Sakisra!
A Nephilim fired an asp blast in his direction, and he pulled back just as the bolt struck his shelter, dangerously close to his arm. Coming out of his role, Kane didn't hesitate to take advantage of the respite from the asp barrage afforded him by Grant and Bridget Baptiste. Depressing the trigger stud of his Sin Eater, he emptied the entire magazine in a thundering drum roll and whine of ricochets. The Nephilim staggered and stumbled, colliding with one another. When the firing pin of his handgun struck the empty chamber, Kane flexed his wrist tendons to retract the Sin Eater into the holster. At the same time, he unclipped his copperhead from beneath his coat. Bounding to his feet and placing the stock against his shoulder, he aligned Enlil's skull before the sights. The kill dot from the laser auto-targeter shone like a pinpoint of blood against the dark gold scales on his forehead.
Kane.
The chord of recognition and the sharp voice so startled Kane he didn't squeeze the subgun's trigger, but the edge of familiarity didn't warm his blood. He caught a shifting of shadows on the right side of the altar, and two figures emerged from behind it. One was considerably taller than the other, his clawed hands tight around Balaam's slender throat. Spur-tipped thumbs pricked the hinges of Balaam's jaw. The crest of spines on the Overlord's skull gleamed blue, a cobalt blue, as did his smart metal armor.
Do you know me, Kane?
I know who you used to be, Baron Cobalt. But it's Lord Marduk now, isn't it?
Marduk always, Kane. I just didn't realize it. I presume you know who I have here with me.
Balaam's heavy-lidded eyes were half-closed and his big head wobbled on his neck. Kane wondered if the overlords, several of whom had crept out from behind the altar, had abused him, or whether he suffered an after-effect of psychically sharing Rasura's moment of death.
What do you want us to do, Kane?
Stay put for the time being. Wait and see what happens.
What kind of strategy is that?
A piss-poor one. But it's the only one I've got.